Chapter 3, Continued. Arrogance or resourcefulness? Some woman wrote a book about spending a year in a women's prison for drug running. Something about orange and black. She was a young, upper-middle-class, well-educated white woman. Somebody gave her a crappy one-star book review saying she appeared to be condescending and arrogant. This was, in part, for claiming that while she was in prison, she was able to get along with everyone and was everyone's best friend. The book claimed that she accomplished this by helping others, often falling back on her education, maybe helping with legal work, for example. Well, remember how I spoke about the importance of finding your niche in prison? What this woman did was just that. To call that arrogant is arrogant. First of all, few people behind bars have a college education. So there is a much higher premium on educated help and advice in prison than there is on the outside. In addition, the majority of detainees and inmates I met along the way were represented by public defenders because they couldn't afford attorneys. Nothing personal, but for the most part, relying on a public defender to go out of his or her way to help you is often a miserable proposition. When you're behind bars, you need all the help you can get, and believe it or not, sometimes a shrewd, well-educated inmate can actually offer better advice than a deadbeat PD. Second, if it works for you, if it helps you to survive, you do it. There were guys who had nothing to offer but a serious beatdown, and they used it to push people around because that's all they had. Some of these guys ended up in groups and gangs where intimidation was their game. Others always managed to have money for commissary, and they used merchandise to pay people off. And let's not forget the guys who were expert at mouthing high-demand medications, which were used to wheel and deal for what they wanted. The bottom line is that education is a commodity, and just like any other gift or attribute, there is a value attached to it. And in prison, that value is quite high. You've got to leverage your power. Remember, prison is a microcosm of society, a bubble, a vacuum, or whatever you choose to call it. But there is still a nexus between the free world and the world of incarceration. What I mean is that all of us use our assets to attain and maintain goals and relationships, and arrogance has nothing to do with it. Here's a closing thought. I once read this quote by Rick Castro. The higher up you go, the more gently you have to reach down to help other people succeed. It's just a fact. Tipping the scale? In the county jail, non-U.S. citizen detainees seem to get far better accommodations and humane treatment than we did. Some shithead CO once tried to tell me that it was because they weren't all there for criminal activity and were just being held in custody until further notice. Sorry, but that's just bullshit. Half the guys on my tier were awaiting trial and were therefore not legally guilty of anything because they hadn't even been convicted and sentenced yet. More likely, the more humane treatment was because the county facility is compelled to follow federal government guidelines for non-U.S. citizens. With direct federal oversight, the local yokels had to watch their asses and actually follow the rules. For us local boys, they could bend the rules to suit themselves. Anyway, these non-citizen detainees were isolated from the rest of us and received more perks and fewer restrictions than we U.S. citizens. Perks such as reasonable access to computers, contact visits, and less restrictive telephone use, just to name a few. Don't get me wrong, I didn't have anything personal against these guys, just the system itself. My two biggest gripes were the expensive and convoluted process for setting up a phone account and making a lousy phone call, and the no-contact visit policy for us Americans. First, let's talk about the phone. Yes, there are phones available for prisoner use. In the facilities I visited, there seemed to be about 3 phones per 50 inmates. Yes, you are allowed access to these phones during rec time and tier time. That sounds wonderful, right? Wrong. You can hardly do a damn thing with a jail phone without first having someone from the outside open a special account for you. Accounts are opened with private entities such as Global Tellink and others who offer a local calling rate of about 25 cents a minute. These accounts must be opened by your friend or relative on the outside, and they must pay a processing fee, load the account up with money, and then maintain a running balance that is gradually etched away as you make your phone calls, just like one of those prepaid credit cards or a debit card. If you had no one on the outside willing and able to set up an account for you, you were out of luck, and many guys fell into this category. We were given 10 minutes per call, after which time we were promptly disconnected. Just as an aside, a detainee's phone calls are not private. The authorities can eavesdrop or record your conversations at will. So, what's my issue with the phone call process? For me, it was the limited time allotted per call and the cost. Besides prisoners and assholes, who the hell pays 25 cents a minute plus fees to make a local call? Still worse is the fact that you're limited to 10 minutes. The facility isn't paying for the freaking call. You and your family are. And on top of that, you're paying through the nose. Limiting a detainee's phone time is meaningless and pompous. Then there's the no-contact visit rule. You've seen it on TV. You're on one side of the glass and your visitor is on the other. You know, I eventually got to the point where I could handle just about anything and everything that came with being locked up. But I despise the fucking authorities who wouldn't allow me to hug my wife and family when they visited. It used to kill me. Visiting day was the most invigorating, exciting, and fulfilling event to look forward to in jail. There was nothing better. But it always turned out to be an emotional roller coaster because it hurt so much to have only 20 minutes to see your loved ones, and you had to do it behind a glass fucking window on a phone receiver. The only real reason for no contact visits was the concern for drugs and contraband being brought into the facility. For guys like me, whose charges had nothing to do with drugs whatsoever, there was no reason for such restrictions. How hard would it be to determine which offenders posed a drug smuggling threat and which ones did not? It absolutely can be done, and state prison is my proof. Yes, we'll talk later about how well the state prison handled contact visits. No more ranting and whining from me. Everything else was just peachy. Telephone wars. Yes, visiting day and phone calls were extremely important to me. I called either my wife or a family member on almost every break, and my wife was always there for me on visiting day. For the most part, there were no glitches, and I thank God for being able to have that connection with the outside world. For me, this connection was a lifesaver. That said, the phone situation could get really ugly at times and could cause some considerable problems. One of the biggest problems was called tag-teaming the phones. Just as you would expect, if you wanted to make a call, you had to stand and wait in a line until one of the phones became free, and then just step up to an available phone and make your call. This worked fine for most of us reasonable adults on the tier. But then there were groups of mainly young guys who had to be running around like freaking babies at all times and couldn't bear that they might have to stand in line to make a phone call like the rest of us did. So they would tag team one or more of the phones. Tag teaming meant when the first guy finished his call, he would stand there and hand off the phone to another guy who was off playing cards, watching TV, taking a shower, doing whatever. Then that guy would do the same thing and hand the phone to the next guy, and the next. You get the picture. That meant that the rest of us guys had to stand there like assholes waiting for a chance at the phones, the whole while watching the clock tick away and realizing we might not get to make our call at all before our rec time ended. The COs wanted nothing to do with the tag-teaming issue. They didn't want much to do with anything on the tier that was for the benefit of the detainees. So once again, the guys who gave a damn about the tag-teaming problem had to get creative and work out our own solution. Of course, there was always Plan A, which was to just kick the tag teamers' asses, but that would most likely get you put in solitary. We put our heads together and came up with a non-confrontational plan. This one was actually all mine. It was simple, and it was musical. We would sing. That's right. Every time the tag team assholes started to do their thing, we would gather around the phone they were on and sing as loudly as we could into their faces. Sometimes Jingle Bells, sometimes a Beatles song, and even Mary Had a Little Lamb would do the trick. After a few confrontations and scuffles, the tag team assholes gave up and waited in line to make their calls like the rest of us mindful individuals. Of all the songs we sang in the faces of the tag team assholes, the favorite seemed to be the old 1980s song, 8675309, Jenny, by Tommy Two Tone. Everybody knew that one. Unlucky. There was this one guy who always stood out in the crowd. For whatever reason, he managed to grab everyone's attention and keep everyone guessing. That was Lucky. He was a tough little bastard, a local boy at the county facility. Although he was really just a big goofball kid in a man's body, he was still intimidating enough to keep everyone around him on guard and a little off kilter. This guy was nonstop, like the Energizer Bunny with crooked teeth and a bad attitude. Lucky had a cousin and an uncle on the same tier, and he had a sister and another cousin in the women's section of the same facility. The whole family had apparently been in and out of this jail facility throughout the years like a vacation home in the Hamptons. It might sound like I'm stating the obvious, but I came to recognize the guys who had spent lots of time in jail because they were the best at doing it. You could pick them out from the minute they arrived on the tier. They were the ones who seemed unaffected by the whole experience and had a knack for swiftly dominating and intimidating their way around without a hitch. Those were also the guys who annoyed me so much at Rikers. Why? It just got on my nerves. When you're a responsible adult and you've got the weight of the world on your shoulders as you contemplate your upcoming prison sentence, it sucks having a bunch of smart-ass losers boogieing around like they're at the shopping mall or high school gym class. No, I don't mean all of them, but many. For whatever reason, Lucky wanted to be my friend. Maybe he needed a father figure in his life. Or maybe it was the fact that I gave him stuff from my commissary, like coffee, crackers, and other items I really didn't care much about, because I felt bad for him. Like a lot of the guys, he had no one on the outside who would give him money for commissary. I had pictures of my kids in my cell. He was enamored with the picture of my 24-year-old daughter. Of course, this really annoyed me at first, and I was constantly kicking his skeevy ass out of my cell for staring at the photo of her. Then one day, I walked into my cell from the shower and caught him staring at the picture again. When I grabbed his shoulder to spin him around and throw him the fuck out of my cell, I saw that he was crying. He was standing there like a big baby with tears in his eyes, which he denied, of course. I was a bit stunned and asked, "What the hell is wrong with you?" He started rambling on about how he had never had a family and just wanted to be like everyone else, and how he wished he could marry a girl like my daughter. I stopped him there. "Oh, geez, what the fuck do I do with this?" I asked myself. Do I pat this psycho kid on the head and tell him everything's gonna be okay? Do I tell him to fuck off and throw his ass out of my cell? Well, I kinda did both. I gave him some of that good old fatherly advice and told him that he had a long life ahead of him and that someday he would marry someone and have a family of his own. I told him he'd have to act right and get a job and prove himself as a good, responsible, and caring man. And then I threw him the hell out of the cell with a warning that he'd never get another commissary item from me again if I caught him looking at my pictures. The irony of all this was that I didn't believe a word that I told him. He was so fucked up in the head that his chances of ever dealing with the outside world and making a life for himself seemed slim to none. I'm sorry, but it's pretty fucking hard to grow apples on an orange tree. Months later, my notions were confirmed when I heard through the grapevine that his charges jumped up from credit card fraud to first-degree murder. He was going to state prison for a long, long time. Keep dreaming about that family, Lucky. It's probably the best dream you'll ever have. The farce that it is. I'm going to go a little off the reservation on this one, so please humor me. This is one of my personal pet peeves. Environmentalists would absolutely cringe at how much water is wasted in jails and prisons. It shouldn't surprise anyone that water consumption might be high in these facilities, but here's a situation that goes beyond the pale of high consumption and is, in fact, just plain old irresponsible. Better yet, inexcusable. First, let me just say that detainees take first place on the list of abusers, and there's absolutely no concern for water conservation on their part. Endless and totally unnecessary toilet flushing and water running in the sink is the norm, and this is perpetuated by detainees with reckless abandon. Yet for a detainee, this is not so surprising. You could easily argue that the last thing an inmate is likely to have on his mind is water conservation, because the basic essentials of life, such as eating, sleeping, and self-preservation, take precedence over all else. However, there is absolutely no excuse for the officials who run these facilities. For them to ignore and outright abuse the conservation of water is absolutely inexcusable. When it comes to practical, common-sense approaches to maintaining highly populated facilities, the expectation is that public officials should be held accountable for the decisions and actions they take in doing so. It's maintenance 101, right? Appropriate action should be taken when a maintenance problem arises. Well then, why shouldn't water and simple plumbing maintenance be dealt with appropriately? Not to mention the fact that there is always a price to pay for a lack of action. By now you're asking, where's he going with this, and why the hell is he talking about plumbing? Who gives a shit? Well, the answer is simple. I want to illustrate the complete lack of logic, concern, and responsibility that sometimes exists on the part of those who we trust the most, those we expect to be responsible and to do the right thing. The supposed pillars of justice are, in this instance, the overseers of our jail and prison facilities. Having lots of time on your hands as you waste away in jail, you find ways of staying busy. That's why I decided to work out a little calculation which illustrates the outrageous waste of resources I witnessed day in and day out at the county facility. I counted the amount of days, the number of gallons, and the associated costs incurred by the senseless waste of water and sheer lack of concern by the administration. Here we go. I once watched a shower remain running 24 hours a day for 34 days straight before it was finally repaired. I watched a sink run full blast for 57 days before it was only partially repaired. I watched a toilet run for 62 days before a plumber was called in to repair it. To keep it fairly simple, I'll stop there. But believe me, this was just the tip of the iceberg. To make my case, I'll focus on just these three particular incidents and illustrate the complete lack of regard on the part of law enforcement officials at the county facility. The shower equation. To take a 15-minute shower every day, the average person uses 915 gallons of water in a month. With the shower running 24 hours straight, and assuming you could take four 14-minute showers in an hour, that's 96 showers. Now, 96 showers at 915 gallons per shower equals 87,840 gallons of water use per day. So 87,840 gallons times 34 days equals 2,986,560 gallons of water wasted. The sink equation. With a faucet running full blast, you waste about 48 gallons of water an hour. So 48 gallons per hour times 24 hours in a day equals 1,152 gallons per day. Now, 1,152 gallons times 57 days equals 65,664 gallons of wasted water. The toilet equation. A toilet running all day uses about 150 gallons of water a day. So, 150 gallons times 62 days equals 9,300 gallons of water wasted. Therefore, not even considering sewer costs, which are based on the amount of the outward flow of water down the drain, and not even considering other incidents beyond the tip of the iceberg examples I've given, here's the consequential damage and the associated cost, according to the U.S. Geological Survey and Environmental Protection Agency standards. A total of 3,061,524 gallons of water was wasted due to the negligence of the facility. At a U.S. average cost of $2 per 1,000 gallons of water, that's about $3,062. Now, in a facility of six tiers, we would have to assume they were experiencing similar water issues. So that's $3,062 times six tiers, which amounts to $18,372 of your tax dollars going straight down the drain in a two-month period. Who the hell knows why? To avoid a $500 plumbing bill? One can only guess. It's hard to even fathom what those figures would be if a detainee's personal water abuse, sewer costs, and other incidences of water waste were included in the equation. Then consider that this waste and abuse is happening at thousands of other correctional facilities throughout the country, 24/7. The numbers are astronomical. It boggles the mind. So what's my point? Simply this. Accountability cuts both ways. Our expectation of detainees and inmates is that they should be held accountable for their actions, and that's why they ended up incarcerated. Well then, so should those who run our jails and prison facilities be held accountable when they are blatantly negligent and disrespectful of our natural resources and taxpayers. Things like the IRS scandal, the Veterans Administration scandal, and other governmental blunders and waste come to mind. Come on now, the government should be held fully accountable just like the rest of us. That's all. Oh, and one last thing. Remember the shower that ran for 34 days straight? Well, it was only the hot water that was working. Without any cold water to add to the mix, the shower water was literally scalding hot. I mean dangerously hot. Very few of us on the tier even attempted to use the shower during that period of time, which makes for a whole cluster of interesting and pungent hygiene issues, but that's not even the point. This shower water was actually hot enough to blister your skin if you were stupid enough to dive right in, and a few guys were, and did. Quite a few guys were walking around with red blotches and burns on their bodies. I was able to deal with it by taking a towel into the shower, wetting it in the scalding water, letting it cool down a bit, and then squeezing the water over my body, which I did for 34 days straight. Nice, huh? The new kid on the block. A new kid showed up on the tier. He was about 20 years old. You could tell immediately that he was scared shitless and he tried hard to remain unnoticed. In the outside world, it's not too difficult to live your life in the background, under the wire, or incognito as a defense mechanism or to avoid confrontation. Sorry, kid, not in jail. There, it's inevitable. Like a contest where the odds are measured, a strategy is established, and someone eventually steps up and challenges you. Everyone knows everything anyone does or tries to do or say, always. It only took a day or so for this kid to be confronted. For the first week on the tier, while everyone was sitting at their tables and eating meals, this kid had to sit on the floor with his tray of food because no one would let him sit at a table. You see, there was a hierarchy of seating arrangements, and you had to earn your table and seat. Most guys managed to do this almost immediately, either schmoozing their way to a spot by befriending someone else at a particular table, or making it known that they were willing to fight for their spot if anyone should choose to challenge them. The new kid did neither. He tried a few times to sit at a table but was knocked down, tray and all. He just picked up what he could and went back to sit on the floor. The more that time went on, the worse the kid was being treated. The way animals pick at the weak and the wounded, it was really beginning to make me sick and angry. Let's digress a minute. I managed to stay strong and focused throughout most of my journey, and for a nonviolent man in his early 50s, I was able to develop a persona that was intimidating enough to keep the general population from messing with me. A few fistfights where you come out on top are usually enough to earn this status, and I did. But deep inside, I was not cut out for fighting and all the tough guy bullshit. Not only was I too old and wise for that crap, but I didn't have the heart to watch some of the more timid guys being hammered by the psycho assholes on the tier who thrived on torturing the lost souls and the weak-hearted. One day I just lost it. The new kid was once again sitting on the floor with his dinner tray. I got up from my table and walked over to him where he was crouched in the furthest corner of the tier eating his dinner. I told him to get up and follow me. Hesitantly, he did. We walked back to the table where I sat. I told him to sit down at an empty space next to me. He started to shake and almost dropped his tray of food, but he sat down at the table with me. Then I said, "From now on, this is where you sit," loud enough for everyone on the tier to hear me. It was a big risk, and I wasn't sure if he or I would be challenged, but we weren't. I learned that his name was Andre. Over the next few weeks, things seemed to be getting better for him. He had befriended a few other guys on the tier, and I moved on, never really having much to do with him again. About a month went by, and my friends and I were hanging out at our usual spot during rec time. All of a sudden, there was insane screaming coming from the upstairs bathroom, and a bunch of guys scrambling around and running to their cells. Andre was thrown into a scalding shower by his supposed new friends. Every time he tried to get out of the scalding hot water, he was pushed back in. He was burned badly. Why? It was because Andre decided to spill the beans about why he was in jail. It turns out that he was there on arson charges. Not just that, but rumor had it that there were kids in the house he torched. And they received third-degree burns and were permanently scarred. They were nearly killed in the incident. A few guys always managed to get a newspaper onto the tier, and we had all read about the horrendous arson incident in the newspaper a month earlier, but never made the connection. It wasn't hard for me to reconcile between my initial compassion for the new kid being hammered by the psycho assholes and the heartless piece of shit who could burn and almost kill two innocent kids. My perspective was entirely turned. I spoke to the guys who did this to Andre, and one of them blurted out a sarcastic little rap that started with, "Tit for tat, when you in jail, that's where it's at." Another guy just said, "You don't burn houses with kids in them. The little psycho prick deserved it." Who could argue with that? From that point forward, nobody wanted anything to do with Andre, so his life on the tier was a living hell. Back to square one for the new kid on the block. Above the fold. When the proverbial shit hits the royal fan, you find out quickly who your friends are. It's amazing. That old cliche about how everyone wants to be your best friend when you're on top of your game and then drop your ass like a hot fucking potato when you're down, is so blatantly true. In fact, some will actually walk by and give you a few kicks in the teeth while you wallow in your demise. With few exceptions, this rang true for me. It was the afternoon lull on the tier. Guys were just hanging around playing cards, watching the crappy little busted-up TV in the corner of the tier, passing around portions of the one and only two-day-old newspaper. staring out the window, or just doing a bunch of nothing. Somebody across the tier from me yelled, "Hey, look at this!" I saw a bit of a scuffle and guys gathering around to look at something in the newspaper. "That's him! The old guy over there," he said. And I noticed a group of guys all turned to look at me. The group headed over to me with the newspaper, and one guy said, "You made front page, above the fold." To me, this really sucked. To them, it was a badge of honor. To me, reading the one-sided, chest-pounding rhetoric being quoted by the authorities and the lynch mob frenzy that surrounded my case turned my stomach. But to the young guys on the tier, the higher the profile, the badder the dude. In any case, these guys actually taught me something. I'd never heard the term above the fold, meaning front page headline news. So it felt a little surreal having everyone gather around me as if it were some kind of rite of passage. There were many more articles to come. Yes, for a stretch, I was in the papers regularly, gradually making my way down to pages 2 and 3. Most of the articles were sensationalized and annoying for me to read. It wasn't enough for them to just state the facts. The powers that be just couldn't get over themselves for supposedly apprehending me, completely ignoring the part where I returned to the United States with the sole intention of turning myself in. As ridiculous as it seems, I was even touted by the prosecutor and placed right up there on the same pedestal with a guy at the same facility who was charged with first-degree murder and a list of other glaringly violent criminals. Hey now, I guess they gotta earn them brownie points wherever they can get them. In the midst of all the overblown media attention about me and my charges, I wrestled with the feeling of isolation and abandonment as I struggled to deal with the fact that essentially no one ever stepped up to simply say, "Hey, he may be guilty of this crime, but I've known him for years and he is a damn good man." Sadly, I waited for that day, that moment, that instance where I would read an article that might include just one fucking kind word, but nothing. And more nothing after that. Eventually, I latched on to this bit of profundity written by Thomas Paine, which helped me to come to terms with my anger and my heartache. He wrote, "Reputation is what men and women think of us. Character is what God and angels know of us." Let me translate that into prison lingo. God knows, and everyone else blows. How about you? Are you one of those credulous people who think the bonds of true friendship can never be broken? Do you think or say things like, "Oh, not him, not her, they would never abandon me"? Guess again, sucker. You don't know jack shit about your friends until you become society's underdog, one of the accused, expelled, and incarcerated. Count all those true friends you think you have in your life right now and cherish the moment. Here are a few cliches for you. "Now is just a snapshot in time," or "Friends are like dust in the wind." Someone I used to know once said, "In the flash of a moment, they'll blow away like the clouds." He'd say, "Maybe you'll blow away the clouds, but you won't feel nothing when I'm gone." Home, that is. Anything for a cold drink. Crazy shit goes on in jail. Things that people wouldn't dream of doing on the outside somehow become acceptable in the chaotic world of incarceration. In county jail, you get 3 square meals a day, and if you have someone on the outside sending you a little money, you can order limited items from the commissary. The only means of heating your food is hot water because there is no heat source for heating coffee, soup, etc. So if hot water doesn't do it for you, you're out of luck. And the closest you're going to get is lukewarm. In contrast, the closest thing to cold you will find is the cold water you get from the sink in your cell. So there is no way to keep things cold either, except one. The water in the toilet maintains an exceptionally cold temperature thanks to the hard, cold stainless steel that these lovely prison-style toilet-sink combos are made of. You see where I'm going with this? Bingo! Many of the guys stored milk, juice, and other sealed containers submerged in the icy cold water of their toilets. They would toss these items in a sock or their fishnet laundry bag and hang them in the toilet. For me, and many others, the thought alone made us sick, and warm drinks were a much better option. But to many, this was the norm. It's amazing how being treated like a helpless creature in a cage can lower your standards and defy your common sense to the point that storing food containers in your toilet is considered acceptable. Big Red's TV Mystery. Once upon a time, 50 guys shared one television. It was located at the corner of Tier L105 at the county jail. You guessed it, control of the TV was always a confrontational and volatile issue. There were constant arguments and fights and sometimes even, drumroll please, sabotage. I didn't pay too much attention to TV, but a group of us used to like to watch reruns of shows like The Sopranos, Cops, and a few other daytime doozies. Most of the young guys used to like watching MTV or Ultimate Fighting and other sports programs. The black contingent watched a little of everything, but mostly wanted to blast some rap station they managed to find. So for the most part, this was the semi-regular pattern on the tier. But then came Big Red. He was a big black dude who, right out of nowhere, decided that he was king of the TV. He would sit about 3 feet in front of it and control the who, what, and when of the TV. So after we just couldn't stand it any longer, we tried to put Plan A into action, which was to enlist the help of someone who was willing to kick his ass. Actually, most everything in jail started with Plan A, an ass-kicking, and then you moved on from there. 9 times out of 10, it worked. But there was a problem in this case. The only guys who were capable of taking him down were guys who didn't give a damn about the TV. So, no dice. For quite a few weeks, Big Red was king of the TV. At first, this was a real quandary. But eventually, we were able to devise Plan B. It was a plan of sabotage. About 6 of us decided that if we couldn't watch TV, then he wasn't going to watch TV either. We waited until count time was called and everyone started to clear the tier. A few of us went to grab the CO's attention by bullshitting and complaining about the scalding shower water, while a few others lingered around the TV until the last possible second. One guy unplugged and ripped the power wire out of the back of the TV and shoved the disconnected end into an opening through the back of it. Another guy poured a few glasses of water into it through a top vent. The next time Big Red came out to the tier, we all watched from the second floor as he tried everything he could think of to get that freaking TV working. He shook it, pounded on it, and don't ask me why, turned it upside down. We were laughing uncontrollably and had to move out of sight so that no one would figure out we had something to do with the TV dilemma, especially him. It actually took him a full 10 minutes or so to figure out that the power wire had been ripped loose. He was pissed. He was jumping up and down and yelling across the tier, "I'm gonna kill the motherfucker who messed with my TV!" Within about 24 hours, some other genius figured out how to reconnect the power wire. Big Red was right there, ready to pounce on the TV as soon as that wire was repaired. But remember, they didn't know that not only was the power wire broken, but water had been poured into the TV too. When Big Red turned it on, the TV started humming, sparking, smoking, until there came a huge bang and it was dead. It was a sight to see. The 6 of us guys who planned this sweet sabotage were proud as hell of our accomplishment. In jail, it's the little things that count. The whole tier was put in lockdown for the next 24 hours, and we no longer had a TV on the tier, but it was well worth it. Big Red was the king of nothing but his own dirty underwear. The kingdom had been overthrown, and all the orange jumpsuit minions rejoiced in contentment and joy. Angels Without Wings, 2. Being in jail for extended periods of time has a way of rattling your brain and recalibrating your mindset. It's a byproduct of being forced into survival mode. Everyone reacts differently, but we all search for and ultimately latch on to that sweet spot or that comfort zone that helps us maintain our sanity. It's just human nature. Some of the hardest times in jail are the silent, lingering hours you spend in the humble confines of your cell. For me, it was that relatively quiet time after the nightly 10 o'clock lights out announcement over the loudspeakers, commonly known as count time. You're lying there staring at the concrete ceiling and contemplating life, recounting the error of your ways, and missing your family so bad that it hurts you to the bone. I'm talking about a pain and longing that most people will never have to endure, and one that I hope I will never feel again. In times like these, people naturally grasp for some peace of mind, some solace and consolation. Unfortunately, having been out of touch with my Christian roots during this disastrous period in my life, I struggled with the notion of just giving it to God, which had always saved me in the past. I did try, but the guilt, the anxiety, the explosive jailhouse environment, and the sheer insanity of my predicament made it extremely difficult to align with my spiritual side. It was just way too chaotic. But as time went on, one thing kept flashing through my mind throughout the months leading up to my ultimate release from incarceration. The woman I met on the airplane while returning to the United States many months earlier. Her face, her words, her voice used to echo through my head, providing me with a feeling of gratifying calm and composure. The only way I could describe it was angelic. Now, I'm a pretty practical guy, and it's not like me to focus on such things, but I began to think of her as my angel without wings. I had never felt such a presence before, nor have I felt one since. But this was an amazing feeling that I cherished and looked forward to in those quiet, sad, and all too miserable hours after Lights Out was called over the loudspeakers. Angels Without Wings, too. There are people led astray. There are those who take your life and walk away. And there are those who sit and wait for judgment. Chef Ramen and the Honey Bun Express. Food in the county jail was as bad as you might imagine. Try to imagine the worst, most bland cafeteria food you've ever had, and then add lots of water. That will give you a good idea of what we're talking about here. Yes, everything was floating in a quarter inch of water, probably because everything was frozen and didn't get thawed before it was fried, baked, or who knows what. There was never a single item that was fresh on the tray, not even a lousy piece of fruit. Literally everything was frozen or came out of a can or box. But you know, it's all relative. There were some guys who actually didn't mind the food and were happy as a clam with the crap we were served. If you ate shit food on the outside, then I suppose jail food would just be more of the same. And that seemed to be the case for at least half the guys on the tier. It's hard for me to fathom, but there's a whole world of people out there who place food and eating last on their priority list. Not at all true for me. Just ask my appetite and my gut. Yes, there were many of us who had a much deeper appreciation for eating well. We ventured to expand our culinary horizons and were determined to come up with other ideas and options. We got pretty creative. Surprisingly, by combining some of the not-so-disgusting cafeteria items with our commissary items, we were able to conjure up some halfway decent things to eat. A group of about 8 of us had a little nightly potluck gathering where we would indulge in the dish of the day. I was the designated chef. If you wanted to be in our potluck group, a commitment was required. You had to contribute certain items from your commissary and dinner tray. If you didn't, you were out. No contribution, no food. So here's a quick example of what I'm calling halfway decent. One of the big favorites was what I called the Super 7 burrito, which stood for our tier number and the number of ingredients in the burrito. From the commissary, I was able to get tortillas, ramen noodles, barbecued corn chips, beef sticks, packets of mayonnaise and mustard, and the cheese packet from a package of macaroni and cheese. Of course, there were no utensils other than plastic sporks and knives. So all these items were crushed or chopped appropriately and then mixed with hot water in an empty corn chip bag, shaken profusely, and steeped for about 10 minutes until creamy. This tasty mixture was placed on your tortilla and rolled into a surprisingly pleasant little burrito that everyone on the tier was envious of. If we really wanted to splurge, the eight of us would agree to save a piece of our frozen meatloaf, hamburger, hot dog, or frozen chicken from dinner and add it to our burrito mix. Then there was dessert. How about a fudge brownie, cornbread, peanut butter cake with a melted chocolate candy bar syrup? Or a honey bun, cream cheese, and sunflower nut cake? You might think this sounds insane, but if you really want something badly enough, you'll find a way to make it happen. A little goes a long way in jail, so every tiny morsel of added pleasure is highly appreciated and embraced with gusto. Hey, have you ever had a cornbread layer cake with peanut butter cream cheese and grape jelly filling? You don't know what you're missing. The Day of Reckoning. Going to trial did not make sense in my case. With a few exceptions, I wasn't denying that I was guilty of the charges being brought against me, so there was little to argue about in a courtroom. Therefore, a plea deal made the most sense. The plea offer was simple. Plead guilty to one charge and accept a 5-year sentence in state prison. I was of the opinion that a 3 or 4 year sentence would be fair and reasonable and did not like the idea of 5. You see, by this point in time, I had become well-versed in the sentencing process and, more specifically, in the state parole eligibility requirements. I knew that a 5-year sentence would imply a much longer wait time before I would be eligible for release on parole. In addition, after receiving a copy of my discovery package, which is basically a snapshot of the evidence the opposing party intends to use against you, I was excited to tell my attorney that many of the charges could be disputed or justified, almost 2/3 of them. He was completely unimpressed and said, "Sorry, bud, even if only one of these charges is real, you face the same outcome in terms of sentencing. Let's not waste our time." After a few rounds of bullshit between my attorney and the prosecutor, it was settled. I would plead guilty to just one of the many charges levied against me. This came across better in theory and on paper, but really meant nothing in terms of sentencing. It was 5 years just the same. And so the infamous day of reckoning fell upon me. It was my long-awaited sentencing day. All of the anticipation and speculation preceding that moment seemed pointless as I was cuffed, placed in waist irons and leg irons, and shuffled in and out of the courtroom in about 10 minutes. It was about as anticlimactic as a wet firecracker. Except for the part where I had to sign the plea agreement, with handcuffs attached to waist irons, I was left with about 6 inches to work with. I noticed a stupid grin on the face of the court clerk and the court officer as I struggled to lean over the edge of the desk to write my signature, dropping the pen 4 times in the process. Now I'd finally become more than just a detainee. I had left my cell that morning as a mere jailhouse detainee and returned to my cell as a guilty man, a condemned man, a convict. Write my book for me. I met Lonnie at county after the infamous Kool-Aid War. That was the time I grabbed the pitcher of Kool-Aid from the black lunch table in an effort to settle the ridiculous yet agonizing battle over who got the extra pitcher of Kool-Aid at dinner time. Lonnie was the guy who watched that event unfold and then nodded in approval of my action. He was a black guy in his late 30s. Although I had seen him on the tier, I'd never spoken to him before the day he approached me to tell me what a brave soul I was to stand up and stake claim to equal Kool-Aid rights. He hung out with the resident black crowd, who, for the most part, stuck to themselves. When we started talking, we found out we had something in common. Rikers Island. I knew Rikers from my recent jaunt through the New York criminal justice system. He knew it from spending half his life in and out of there. He amazed me when he would tell me how great it was for him at Rikers and how he wished he could go back there rather than stay in the county facility we were in. My brief stint at Rikers was certainly memorable, but only in the worst of ways. Everybody's ride is different. I guess it's who and what you're most familiar with that makes a place feel like home. Mainly for him, it was tough for us to spend much time hanging around on the tier without running the risk of aggravating the relatively moderate but ever-present black and white divide. Lonnie amazed me. Considering the kind of life he had, which was filled with abuse, neglect, and crime, he had a way about him that was remarkably peaceful, pleasant, and friendly. He was calm and endearing in a way that commanded a lot of respect from those around him. This was a refreshing and extremely unique quality that stood out among all of those on the tier, both black and white. He let me know that he had a lot of respect for me as well. I wasn't sure whether to take it as a compliment or insult when he said, "Man, you're cool like the OG," which stood for the original gangster dudes. "They live by the code," he said, referring to some of the gang leaders he'd met in prison in upstate New York over the years, who still lived by the so-called convict code. These days, this code is less prominent and has been overrun by a new, younger crowd with more of an every-man-for-himself attitude, according to Lonnie. He often told me that both the black and the white contingent on the tier agreed that I was a generous and righteous man. Only half-serious, I tried to explain that the term righteous felon was oxymoronic, to no avail. I was flattered just the same. As I got to know him better, Lonnie asked me if I would help him write a book, a memoir of his life on the streets of New York. I hesitantly agreed, thinking the task was going to be a pain in the ass. As much as I really respected this guy, I was already up to my ears with helping other detainees with their letters and legal work. And so it began. To start, Lonnie brought me about 20 pages to read. The plan was to have me read, correct, comment, and even rewrite his story for him, if necessary. Like so many others on the tier, his spelling and grammar were horrific, but not half as horrific as the story itself. He gave me no forewarning about what I was about to read. I was shocked, excited, and saddened all at once by what I was reading. It was both disturbing and captivating at the same time. Lonnie was basically enlisted into the gang culture at 10 years old and acted as a runner for the older guys who were out there blazing up the neighborhood like New Jack City. He witnessed his first drive-by shooting on his 11th birthday. He was in the vehicle with the shooter. He watched a man get tied up in a basement and shot dead when he was just 13. He was raised in an environment full of drugs, guns, and violence. And this didn't change for him until he was in his late 20s. I gave him a lot of credit. As I read the pages of his book, I could see his transition from a crazy balls-to-the-walls gangbanger to the calm and controlled person that he showed me every day on the tier. His story is a great one. It is a story of a man who managed to break away from and overcome the reality of gang violence and the stigma attached to it. I could go into much more detail and tell you dozens more shocking and disturbing things about Lonnie's life experiences, but I'll let him write that book. What I do want to point out is that I learned something from this young guy. The cliche, "against all odds," would be a huge understatement in describing Lonnie's ability to survive the rock-hard life he had led. What's more amazing is that he managed to carry himself with a level of dignity and righteousness that is difficult to come by these days, inside or outside the walls of prison. Lonnie removed all doubt about whether a man can overcome the worst of circumstances and become an excellent human being, regardless of his troubled home life, his horrific environment, or the color of his skin. I always thought of myself as resilient and strong in dealing with life's downfalls, especially the whole prison experience, but my inner strength and vitality were nothing compared to Lonnie's. Every person who is incarcerated, whether they committed the crime or not, whether they have been sentenced or not, whether they are literate or not, all have one thing in common with those in the outside world. We can all respect good old-fashioned human decency, dignity, and generosity. They are a man's most redeeming qualities and what matter most. That's right. The degree of culpability, speculative judgment emanating from others, cynical public opinion, and a tarnished reputation do not truly define a man. I'm going to say it again. It's what's in a man's soul that defines him, and only God knows what's in a man's soul. Don't judge. I knew I would never forget Lonnie. The day I was shipped out of county jail and off to state prison, I held Lonnie's head between my two hands and kissed his forehead as I said goodbye. At that moment, off to the side of the tier, the black contingent all put their heads down, looked away uncomfortably, and pretended not to notice. And the modest crowd of white guys who were standing next to me, gleefully shouting out their goodbyes, slowly backed away. And for a brief moment, the room fell silent as I was escorted off the tier to make my trek to state prison. And I still